particular. A thought flashed across his mind, but he dismissed it at once. No, it wasn't possible. Paranoia setting in. He'd once been told by a veteran agent that it was always at its worst on your last assignment. But if you were in any doubt, the rule was always the same. Get yourself out of the danger area. He looked around the square, quickly weighing up which exit he should take. The crowd was beginning to calm down as they waited for Zarimsky to speak. Connor decided he would start moving towards the north end of the square the moment there was a burst of prolonged applause. That way it was less likely that he'd be noticed slipping through the crowd. He glanced, almost as a reflex action, to see where Mitchell was. He was still standing a few yards to his right, if anything a little closer than when he had first spotted him. Zarimsky approached the microphone with his hands raised to let the crowd know that he was about to begin his speech.
"I've seen the needle," said Sergei.
"Where?" demanded Jackson.
"There, about 20 paces from stage. He has different colored hair and walks like an old man. You owe me $10.
"How did you pick him out from this distance?" asked Jackson.
"He is the only one trying to leave the square."
Jackson passed over a $10 bill as Zarimsky stopped in front of the microphone. The old man who had introduced him in Moscow sat alone at the back of the stage. Zarimsky didn't allow that kind of mistake to happen a second time. "Comrades," he began resonantly, "it is a great honor for me to stand before you as your candidate. As each day passes, I become more and more aware." As Connor scanned the crowd, he once again caught sight of Mitchell. He'd taken another step towards him. "Although few of our citizens wish to return to the old totalitarian days of the past, the vast majority..." Just the odd word change here and there, thought Connor. He noticed that Mitchell had taken another step towards him. "Want to see a fairer distribution of the wealth that has been created by their skills and hard work." As the crowd began to cheer, Connor quickly moved a few paces to his right. When the applause died down, he froze, not moving a muscle.
"Why is the man on the bench following your friend?" asked Sergei.
"Because he's an amateur," said Jackson.
"Or a professional who knows exactly what he's doing," suggested Sergei.
"My God, don't tell me I'm losing my touch," said Jackson.
"So far, he's done everything but kiss him," said Sergei.
"Look at the streets of St. Petersburg, comrades," continued Zarimsky. "Yes, you will see Mercedes, BMWs, and Jaguars. But who is driving them? Only the privileged few."
When the crowd burst into applause again, Connor took a few more steps towards the north end of the square.
"I look forward to the day when this is not the only country on earth where limousines outnumber family cars."
Connor glanced back to find that Mitchell had taken 2 or 3 more steps in his direction. What was he playing at?
"And where there are more Swiss bank accounts than hospitals."
He would have to lose him during the next burst of applause. He concentrated on Zarimsky's words to anticipate exactly when he would make his move.
"I think I've spotted him,"
said a plainclothes policeman who was sweeping the crowd through a pair of binoculars.
"Where, where?"
demanded Bolchenkov, grabbing the glasses. 12 o'clock, 50 yards back, not moving a muscle. He's in front of a woman wearing a red scarf. He doesn't look like his photograph, but whenever there's a burst of applause, he moves too quickly for a man of that age." Bolchenkov began focusing the glasses.
"Got him," he said.
After a few seconds, he added,
"Yes, it might just be him. Brief those two at 1 o'clock to move in and arrest him, and tell the pair 20 yards in front of him to cover them. Let's get it over with as quickly as possible."
The young officer looked anxious.
"If we've made a mistake," said the chief, "I'll take the responsibility." "Let us never forget," continued Zarimsky, "that Russia can once again be the greatest nation on earth."
Mitchell was now only a pace away from Connor, who was studiously ignoring him. In just a few more seconds, there would be an extended ovation when Zarimsky told the crowd what he intended to do when he became president. No bank accounts supplied by the bribes of dishonest businessmen. That always got the loudest cheer of all. Then he'd be clean away and would make sure that Mitchell was transferred to a desk job in some mosquito-infested backwater.
I shall be dedicating myself to your service and be more than satisfied with the salary of a president rather than taking bribes from dishonest businessmen whose only interest is in pillaging the nation's assets.
The crowd erupted into cheers. Connor turned suddenly and began moving to his right. He had taken almost three strides when the first policeman grabbed his left arm. A second later, another came at him from the right. He was thrown to the ground, but made no attempt to resist. Rule one, when you've nothing to hide, don't resist arrest. His hands were wrenched behind his back and a pair of handcuffs snapped around his wrists. The crowd began to form a little circle around the three men on the ground. They were now far more interested in the sideshow than in Zarinsky's words. Mitchell hung back slightly and waited for the inevitable, "Who is he?" "Mafia hitman," he whispered into the ears of those nearest him. He moved back towards the press enclosure, muttering the words, "Mafia hitman," periodically.
"Let me leave you, good citizens, in no doubt that if I were to be elected president, you can be sure of one thing." "You're under arrest," said a third man, whom Connor couldn't see because his nose was being pressed firmly against the ground. "Take him away," said the same authoritative voice, and Connor was bundled off towards the north end of the square.
This ends Disc 4. The 11th Commandment, Disc 5.
Zarinsky had spotted the disturbance in the crowd, but like an old pro, he ignored it.
"If Chernopov were to be elected, the Americans would be more concerned about the views of Mexico than those of Russia," he continued unfalteringly.
Jackson never took his eyes off Connor as the crowd quickly divided, making a path to allow the police through.
"My friends, there are only 6 days to go before the people decide."
Mitchell walked quickly away from the commotion and headed towards the press stand.
"Don't do it for me. Don't even do it for the Communist Party. Do it for the next generation of Russians."
The police car, surrounded by four motorcycles, began to make its way out of the square.
"Who will then be able to play their part as citizens of the greatest nation on earth? I ask for only one thing, the privilege of being allowed to lead those people."
This time he was silent, until he was sure he had the attention of everyone in the square before ending softly with the words, "Comrades, I offer myself as your servant." He stood back, and suddenly the noise of the police sirens was obliterated by the roar of 100,000 voices. Jackson looked towards the press enclosure. He could see that the journalists were far more interested in the disappearing police car than in Zarinsky's frequently repeated words.
"Mafia hitman,"
the Turkish journalist was informing a colleague, a fact that she had picked up from someone in the crowd whom she would later quote as an authoritative source. Mitchell was looking up at a row of television cameramen who were following the progress of the police car as it disappeared out of sight, its blue lamp flashing. His eyes settled on the one person he needed to speak to. He waited patiently for Clifford Simons to look in his direction, and when he eventually did, Mitchell waved his arms to indicate that he needed to speak to him urgently. The CNN reporter quickly joined the American cultural attaché among the cheering throng. Zarinsky remained in the center of the platform, soaking up the adulation of the crowd. He had no intention of leaving while they were still howling their approval. Simons listened carefully to what Mitchell had to tell him. He was due on air in 12 minutes. The smile on his face became broader by the second.
"Are you absolutely certain?" he asked when Mitchell had finished speaking.
"Have I ever let you down in the past?" Mitchell asked, trying to sound offended.
"No," said Simons apologetically, "you never have. But you must keep this piece of information 1,000,000 miles away from the embassy."
"Of course. But who shall I say is my source?"
"A resourceful and diligent police force. That's the last thing the chief of police is going to deny."
Simons laughed. "I'd better get back to my producer if I'm going to lead on this for the morning newscast."
"Okay," said Mitchell. "Just remember, make sure it can't be traced back to me."
Have I ever let you down in the past? Retorted Simons. He turned and dashed back towards the press enclosure. Mitchell slipped away in the opposite direction. There was still one more receptive ear in which he needed to plant the story, and it would have to be done before Zerinsky left the stage. A protective line of bodyguards was barring any over-enthusiastic supporters from getting near the candidate. Mitchell could see his press secretary only a few yards away, basking in the cheers his leader was receiving. Mitchell told one of the guards in perfect Russian who he needed to speak to. The thug turned around and shouted at the press secretary. If Zerinsky was elected, thought Mitchell, it wasn't exactly going to be a subtle administration. The press secretary made an immediate sign to let the American through, and he entered the cordoned-off area and joined another of his chess partners. He briefed him quickly, telling him that de Villiers had been disguised as an old man, and which hotel he'd been seen leaving just before he'd entered the restaurant. By the end of the day, it would have dawned on Fitzgerald and Jackson that they had both been dealing with a real professional. Chapter 17. The president and his chief of staff sat alone in the Oval Office, watching the early morning news. Neither of them spoke as Clifford Simons presented his report. An international terrorist was arrested in Freedom Square this afternoon during a speech given by the communist leader Viktor Zerinsky. The as-yet-unnamed man is being held in the notorious Crucifix Prison in the center of St. Petersburg. The local police are not ruling out the possibility that this may be the same man who was recently linked with the assassination of Ricardo Guzman, a presidential candidate in Colombia. The man, who police have arrested, is thought to have been following Zerinsky for several days while he was campaigning around the country. Only last week he was described in Time magazine as the most expensive hired gun in the West. He is thought to have been offered $1 million by the Russian mafia to remove Zerinsky from the presidential race. When the police tried to arrest him, it took four of them just to hold him down. Some footage followed of a man being arrested in the crowd and hustled away, but the best shot they had managed was the back of a head covered in a fur hat. Simon's face reappeared on the screen. The communist candidate continued to deliver his speech, although the arrest took place only a few yards in front of the platform. Zerinsky later praised the St. Petersburg police for their diligence and professionalism and vowed that however many attempts were made on his life, nothing would deter him from his fight against organized crime. Zerinsky is currently running neck and neck with Prime Minister Chernopov in the opinion polls, but many observers feel that today's incident will give a boost to his popularity in the final run-up to the election. A few hours before Zerinsky addressed the rally, he held a private meeting with General Borodin at his headquarters on the north side of the city. No one knows the outcome of those talks, but the general's spokesmen are not denying that he will soon be making a statement about whether he intends to continue his campaign for president, and, perhaps more importantly, which of the two remaining candidates he would pledge to support were he to withdraw. The election has suddenly been thrown wide open. This is Clifford Simons, CNN International, in Freedom Square, St. Petersburg. On Monday, the Senate will continue to debate the nuclear, biological, chemical, and conventional arms reduction. The president pressed a button on his remote control, and the screen went blank. And you're telling me that the man they've arrested has no connection with the Russian mafia, but is a CIA agent? Yes. I'm waiting for Jackson to call in and confirm that it's the same man who killed Guzman. What do I say to the press if they question me about this? You'll have to bluff because we don't need anyone to know that the man they're holding is one of ours. But it would finish off Dexter and her little shit of a deputy once and for all. Not if you claimed you knew nothing about it, because then half the population would dismiss you as a CIA dupe. But if you admit you did know, the other half would want you impeached. So for now, I suggest you confine yourself to saying that you are awaiting the result of the Russian elections with interest. You bet I am, said Lawrence. The last thing I need is for that evil little fascist Zerinsky to become president. We'd be back to Star Wars overnight. I expect that's exactly why the Senate is holding out on your arms reduction bill. They won't want to make a final decision until they know the outcome of the election. Lawrence nodded.
If it's one of ours they got holed up in that goddamn jail, we've got to do something about it, and quickly. Because if Zarimsky does become president, then God help him. I certainly wouldn't be able to.
Connor didn't speak. He was wedged between two officers in the back of the police car. He knew these young men had neither the rank nor the authority to question him. That would come later, and from someone with a lot more braid on his lapel. As they drove through the vast wooden gates of the crucifix prison and into a cobbled yard, the first thing Connor saw was the reception party. Three massive men in prisoner's garb stepped forward, almost pulled the car's back door off its hinges, and dragged him out. The young policeman, who had been sitting on either side of him, looked terrified. The three thugs quickly bundled the new prisoner across the yard and into a long, bleak corridor. That was when the kicking and punching began. Connor would have protested, but their vocabulary seemed to consist only of grunts. When they reached the far end of the corridor, one of them pulled open a heavy steel door, and the other two threw him into a tiny cell. He made no effort to struggle when they removed first his shoes, then his watch, wedding ring, and wallet, from which they would learn nothing. They left, slamming the cell door closed behind them. Connor rose slowly to his feet and warily stretched his limbs, trying to discover if any bones had been broken. There didn't seem to be any permanent damage, he decided, although the bruises were already beginning to appear. He looked around the room, which wasn't much larger than the sleeping compartment he traveled in from Moscow. The green brick walls looked as if they hadn't seen a splash of paint since the turn of the century. Connor had spent 18 months in a far more restricted space in Vietnam. Then his orders had been clear. When questioned by the enemy, give only your name, rank, and serial number. The same rules did not apply to those who lived by the 11th commandment. Thou shalt not get caught, but if you are, deny absolutely that you have anything to do with the CIA. Don't worry. The company will always take care of you. Connor realized that in his case he could forget the usual diplomatic channels, despite Guttenberg's reassurances. Lying on the bunk in his tiny cell, it now all fell so neatly into place. He hadn't been asked to sign for the cash or for the car. And he now remembered the sentence he'd been trying to recall from the recesses of his mind. He went over it word by word. If it's your new job you're worrying about, I'd be happy to have a word with the chairman of the company you're joining and explain to him that it's only a short-term assignment. How did Guttenberg know he'd been interviewed for a new job and that he was dealing directly with the chairman of the company? He knew because he'd already spoken to Ben Thompson. That was the reason they had withdrawn their offer. I'm sorry to inform you. As for Mitchell, he should have seen through that angelic choirboy facade, but he was still puzzled by the phone call from the president. Why had Lawrence never once referred to him by name? And the sentences had been a little disjointed, the laugh a little too loud. Even now he found it hard to believe the lengths to which Helen Dexter was willing to go to save her own skin. He stared up at the ceiling. If the president had never made the phone call in the first place, he realized he had no hope of being released from the crucifix. Dexter had successfully removed the one person who might expose her, and Lawrence could do nothing about it. Connor's unquestioning acceptance of the CIA operative's code had made him a willing pawn in her survival plan. No ambassador would be making diplomatic protests on his behalf. There would be no food parcels. He would have to take care of himself just as he had in Vietnam. And he had already been told by one of the young officers who'd arrested him of another problem he would face this time. No one had escaped from the crucifix in 84 years. The cell door suddenly swung open, and a man dressed in a light blue uniform covered in gold braid walked in. He took his time lighting a cigarette, his 15th that day. Jackson remained in the square until the police car was out of sight. He was furious with himself. He finally turned and marched off, leaving the cheering mob behind him, walking so quickly that Sergei had to run to keep up with him. The young Russian had already decided that this was not a time to be asking questions. The word Mafia was on the lips of everyone they passed in the street. Sergei was relieved when Jackson stopped and hailed a taxi. Jackson could only admire how well Mitchell, no doubt guided by Dexter and Guttenberg, had carried out the whole operation. It was a classic CIA sting, but with a difference. This time, it was one of their own they had ruthlessly left, languishing in a foreign jail. He tried not to think about what they would be putting Connor through. Instead, he concentrated on the report he was about to make to Andy Lloyd. If only he had been able to contact him the previous night, he might have got the go-ahead to pull Connor out. His cell phone still wasn't working, so he was going to have to risk using the phone in his hotel room. After 29 years, he had been given one chance to balance the books, and he had been found wanting. The taxi stopped outside Jackson's hotel. He paid the fare and ran inside. Not bothering to wait for the elevator, he leapt up the stairs until he reached the first floor and then sprinted down the corridor to room 132. Sergei had only just caught up with him by the time he had turned the key and opened the door. The young Russian sat on the floor in the corner of the room and listened to one half of a conversation Jackson had with someone called Lloyd. When he eventually put the phone down, Jackson was white and trembling with rage. Sergei spoke for the first time since they had left the square.
"Maybe it's time I called one of my mother's customers."
"Congratulations," said Dexter the moment Guttenberg entered her office. The deputy director smiled as he took the seat opposite his boss and placed a folder on her desk. "I've just been watching the headlines on ABC and CBS," she said. "They've both run with Simon's version of what took place in Freedom Square. Is there any feel yet as to how big the press are going to play the story tomorrow?" "They're already losing interest. Not a shot was fired, not even a punch was thrown. And the suspect turned out to be unarmed, and no one's suggesting that the man they've arrested might be an American. By this time tomorrow, the story will only be making the front pages in Russia." "How are we responding to any press inquiries?" "We're saying that it's an internal problem for the Russians and that in St. Petersburg, hired gunmen come cheaper than a decent wristwatch. I tell them they only have to read Time's piece on the Russian Godfather last month to appreciate the problems they're facing. If they push me, I point them in the direction of Colombia. If they keep on pushing, I throw in South Africa. That gives them several column inches to feed their hungry editors." "Did any of the network show footage of Fitzgerald after he'd been arrested?" "Only the back of his head. And even then he was surrounded by police. Otherwise you can be sure that they've run it over and over." "What chance is there of him appearing in public and making a statement that would compromise us and that the press might follow up?"
"Virtually none. And if they ever do hold a trial, the foreign press will certainly be excluded. And if Zarimsky's elected, Fitzgerald will never set foot outside the crucifix again."
"Have you prepared a report for Lawrence?" asked Dexter. "Because you can be sure he'll be trying to make 2 and 2 equal 6. Guttenberg leant forward and tapped the file he had placed on the director's desk. She flicked it open and began reading, showing no sign of emotion as she turned the pages. When she reached the end, she closed the file and allowed a flicker of a smile to cross her face before passing it back across the table. "See that it's signed in your name and sent over to the White House immediately," she said, "because whatever doubts the president may have at this moment, if Zarimsky becomes president, he will never want to refer to the subject again." Guttenberg nodded his agreement. Helen Dexter looked across the desk at her deputy. "It's a pity we had to sacrifice Fitzgerald," she said. "But if it helps to get Zarimsky elected, it will have served a double purpose. Lawrence's arms reduction bill will be rejected by Congress, and the CIA will have far less interference from the White House." Connor swung his legs off the bunk, placed his bare feet on the stone floor, and faced his visitor. The chief took a long drag on his cigarette and blew the smoke high into the air.
"Filthy habit," he said in flawless English. "My wife never stops telling me to give it up."
Connor showed no emotion.
"My name is Vladimir Bolchenkov. I am the chief of police of this city, and I thought we might have a little chat before we think about putting anything on the record."
"My name is Pete de Villiers. I'm a South African citizen working for the Johannesburg Journal, and I wish to see my ambassador."
"Now, there's my first problem,"
said Bolchenkov, the cigarette dangling from the corner of his mouth. You see, I don't believe your name is Piet de Villiers. I'm fairly sure you're not South African, and I know for certain that you don't work for the Johannesburg Journal because there's no such paper. And just so we don't waste too much of each other's time, I have it on the highest authority that you were not hired by the Mafia. Now, I admit that I don't yet know who you are or even which country you come from, but whoever it is that sent you has, to use a modern colloquialism, dropped you in deep shit, and if I may say so, from a very great height. Connor didn't even blink. But I can assure you that they are not going to do the same thing to me. So if you feel unable to assist with my inquiries, there is nothing I can do except leave you here to rot while I continue to bask in the glory that is currently being undeservedly heaped upon me. Connor still didn't react. I see that I'm not getting through to you, said the chief. I feel it's my duty to point out that this isn't Colombia, and that I will not be switching my allegiance according to who I've spoken to most recently, or who offers me the thickest wad of dollars. He paused and drew on his cigarette again before adding, I suspect that's one of the many things we have in common. He turned and began walking towards the cell door, then stopped. I'll leave you to think it over, but if I were in your shoes, I wouldn't wait too long. He banged on the door. Let me assure you, whoever you are, he added as the door was opened, there will be no thumbscrews, no rack, or any other more sophisticated forms of torment while I'm St. Petersburg's chief of police. I don't believe in torture, it's not my style. But I cannot promise you everything will be quite so friendly if Viktor Serimsky is elected as our next president. The chief slammed the cell door closed, and Connor heard a key turn in the lock. Chapter 18. Three white BMWs drew up outside the hotel. The man seated next to the driver in each car leapt out onto the pavement and checked up and down the road. Once they were satisfied, the back door of the middle car was opened to allow Alexei Romanov to step out. The tall young man was wearing a long black cashmere coat and didn't look to either side as he walked quickly into the hotel. The other three men followed, forming a semicircle around him. From the description he had been given over the phone, Romanov immediately recognized the tall American standing in the middle of the hall, looking as if he was waiting for someone. "Mr. Jackson?" inquired Romanov in a guttural accent. "Yes," Jackson replied. He would have shaken hands if Romanov had not simply turned round and headed straight back towards the entrance. The three cars' engines were running, and their doors were still open when Jackson stepped out onto the street. He was ushered towards the back door of the center vehicle and sat between the man who hadn't been willing to shake hands with him and another equally silent but more heavily built man. The three cars slipped into the center lane, and as if by magic, every other vehicle moved out of their path. Only the traffic lights didn't seem to know who they were. As the little motorcade swept through the city, Jackson cursed himself again. None of this would have been necessary if he had been able to get through to Lloyd 24 hours earlier. But that was hindsight, he thought, a gift only politicians are born with.
You need to meet Nikolai Romanov, Sergei had said.
He had dialed his mother's number, and when the phone was eventually answered, he behaved in a way Jackson hadn't witnessed before. He was respectful, listened attentively, and never once interrupted. 20 minutes later, he put the phone down.
I think she'll make the call, he said. The problem is that you can't become a member of the thieves-in-law, or the mafia, as you call them, until you're 14. It was the same even for Alexei, the Tsar's only son.
Sergei went on to explain that he had asked that Jackson should be granted a meeting with the Tsar, the leader of the thieves-in-law. The organization had been founded at the time when Russia was ruled by a real Tsar, and had survived to become the most feared and respected criminal organization in the world.
My mother is one of the few women the Tsar will talk to. She will ask him to grant you an audience, said Sergei.
The phone rang, and he immediately picked it up. As he listened carefully to what his mother had to say, he turned white and began to tremble. He hesitated for some time, but finally agreed to whatever she was suggesting. His hand was still shaking when he put the receiver down.
"Has he agreed to see me?" asked Jackson.
"Yes," said Sergei quietly. "Two men come to pick you up tomorrow morning. Alexei Romanov, the Tsar's son, who will succeed him when he dies, and Stefan Ivanitsky, Alexei's cousin, who is third in command."
"Then what's the problem?"
"As they do not know you, they make one condition."
"And what's that?"
"If the Tsar thinks you waste his time, the two men will come back and break one of my legs to remind me not to bother them again."
"Then you'd better make sure you're not around when I get back."
"If I'm not here, they pay a call on my mother and break her leg. And when they catch me, they break both my legs. It is the unwritten code of the Mafia."
Jackson wondered if he should cancel the meeting. He didn't want to be responsible for Sergei ending up on crutches. But the boy told him it was too late. He had already accepted their terms. One glance at Stefan Ivanitsky, the Tsar's nephew who was seated on his right, was enough to convince Jackson that breaking a leg would take him only a moment and would be forgotten even more quickly. Once the BMWs had passed the city boundaries, the little motorcade quickly accelerated to 60 miles per hour. As they climbed the winding roads up into the hills, they met few other vehicles. They sped past peasants on the side of the road with their heads bowed and no sign in their faces that they cared about either the past or the future. Jackson began to understand why Zarimsky's words might excite any last flicker of hope left in them. Without warning, the leading car suddenly swung left and stopped outside a massive wrought-iron gate dominated by a crest with a black falcon's outstretched wings. Two men holding Kalashnikovs stepped forward, and the first driver lowered a smoked glass window to allow them to peer in. It reminded Jackson of arriving outside the CIA's headquarters, except that at Langley the guards had to be satisfied with sidearms that remained in their holsters. After all three cars had been inspected, one of the guards nodded, and the wings of the Falcon split open. The motorcade proceeded at a more stately pace along a gravel drive that wound through a thick forest. It was another 5 minutes before Jackson caught his first glimpse of the house, though house it was not. A century before, it had been the palace of an emperor's firstborn. It was now inhabited by a remote descendant who also believed in his hereditary position.
"Don't speak to the Tsar unless he speaks first," Sergei had warned him, "and always treat him like his imperial ancestors."
Jackson preferred not to tell Sergei that he had no idea how to treat a member of the Russian royal family. The cars crunched to a halt outside the front door. A tall, elegant man in a long black tailcoat, white shirt and bow tie stood waiting on the top step. He bowed to Jackson, who tried to look as if he was used to this sort of treatment. After all, he had once met Richard Nixon.
"Welcome to the Winter Palace, Mr. Jackson," said the butler. "Mr. Romanov awaits you in the Blue Gallery."
Alexei Romanov and Stefan Ivanitsky accompanied Jackson through the open door. Jackson and the young Romanov followed the butler down a long marble corridor, while Ivanitsky remained standing by the entrance. Jackson would have liked to stop and admire the paintings and statues that would have graced any museum in the world, but the steady pace of the butler did not allow it. The butler stopped when he reached two white doors at the end of the corridor that stretched almost to the ceiling. He knocked, opened one of the doors, and stood aside to allow Jackson to enter.
"Mr. Jackson,"
he announced and left the room, closing the door quietly behind him. Jackson stepped into a vast, lavishly furnished drawing room. The floor was covered by a single carpet a Turk would have traded his life for. From a Louis XIV winged chair of red velvet rose an elderly man in a blue pinstriped suit. His hair was silver, and the pallor of his skin suggested that he had suffered a long illness. His thin body was slightly stooped as he took a step forward to shake hands with his guest.
It is kind of you to come all this way to see me, Mr. Jackson, he said. You must forgive me, but my English is a little rusty. I was forced to leave Oxford in 1939, soon after the war broke out, although I was only in my second year. You see, the British never really trusted the Russians, even though we were later to become allies. He smiled sweetly. I'm sure they show much the same attitude when dealing with the Americans.
Jackson wasn't sure how to react.
Do have a seat, Mr. Jackson, said the old man, gesturing towards the twin of the chair he had been sitting in.
Thank you, said Jackson. They were the first words he had spoken since leaving the hotel.
Now, Mr. Jackson, said Romanoff, lowering himself slowly into his chair, if I ask you a question, be sure to answer it accurately. If you are in any doubt, take your time before replying, because should you decide to lie to me, how shall I put it, you will find that it's not only this meeting that will be terminated.
Jackson would have walked out there and then, but he knew that the old man was probably the one person on earth who could get Connor out of the crucifix prison alive. He gave a curt nod to show that he understood.
Good, said Romanoff. And now I should like to learn a little more about you, Mr. Jackson. I can tell at a glance that you work for a law enforcement agency, and as you are in my country,
he emphasized the word my,
I assume it has to be the CIA rather than the FBI. Am I right?
I worked for the CIA for 28 years, until quite recently when I was replaced. Jackson chose his words carefully.
It's against the rules of nature to have a woman as your boss, commented Romanoff without even the suggestion of a smile. The organization I control would never indulge in such stupidity.
The old man leant across to a table on his left and picked up a small glass full of a colorless liquid that Jackson hadn't noticed until that moment. He took a sip and replaced the glass on the table before asking his next question.
Are you currently working for another law enforcement agency?
No, said Jackson firmly.
So you have gone freelance? Suggested the old man.
Jackson didn't reply.
I see, he said. From your silence, I am bound to deduce that you are not the only person who doesn't trust Helen Dexter.
Again, Jackson said nothing, but he was quickly learning why it wouldn't pay to lie to Romanoff.
Why did you want to see me, Mr. Jackson?
Jackson suspected that the old man knew exactly why, but played along with a charade. I came on behalf of a friend of mine who, because of my stupidity, has been arrested and is currently locked up in the crucifix prison.
An establishment that isn't known for its humanitarian record, especially when it comes to considering appeals or granting parole.
Jackson nodded his agreement.
I am aware that it was not your friend who was responsible for informing the press that my organization had offered him $1 million to remove Zarimsky from the presidential race. Had that been the case, he would have been found hanging in his cell long before now. No, I suspect that the person peddling that particular piece of misinformation, Romanoff continued, is one of Helen Dexter's minions. If only you had come to me a little earlier, Mr. Jackson, I could have warned you about Mitchell.
He took another sip from his glass and added,
one of the few of your countrymen I would consider recruiting into my organization. I see you are surprised by the extent of my knowledge.
Jackson thought he hadn't moved a muscle.
Mr. Jackson, surely you wouldn't be shocked to learn that I have my own people well placed in the upper echelons of both the CIA and the FBI.
The thin smile returned to his face.
And if I thought it would prove useful, I would also have someone working for me in the White House. But as President Lawrence will reveal anything he is asked at his weekly news conference, it is hardly necessary. Which leads on to my next question. Your friend works for the CIA?
Jackson didn't reply.
Ah, I see. Just as I thought. Well, I think he can be confident that Helen Dexter will not be riding to his rescue on this occasion.
Jackson still said nothing.
Good, said the old man. So now I know exactly what you expect of me.
He paused. But I am at loss to understand what you have to offer in return.
I have no idea what the going rate is, said Jackson. The old man began laughing.
You can't believe for one moment, Mr. Jackson, that I dragged you out here to discuss money, can you? Look around, and you will see that however much you have to offer, it wouldn't be enough. Time was well short of the mark when it speculated on the extent of my power and wealth. Last year alone, my organization had a turnover of $187 billion, more than the economy of Belgium or Sweden. We now have fully operational branches in 142 countries. A new one opens every month, to paraphrase McDonald's slogan. No, Mr. Jackson, I do not have enough days left on earth to waste any of them discussing money with a penniless man.
Then why did you agree to see me in the first place? Asked Jackson.
You don't ask questions, Mr. Jackson, said Romanoff sharply. You only answer them. I'm surprised that you don't appear to have been properly briefed.
The old man took a further sip of the colorless liquid before spelling out exactly what he expected in return for assisting Connor to escape. Jackson knew he didn't have the authority to accept Romanoff's terms on Connor's behalf, but as he had been instructed not to ask questions, he remained silent.
You may need a little time to think over my proposition, Mr. Jackson, continued the old man. But should your friend agree to my terms and then fail to carry out his side of the bargain, he must be made fully aware of the consequences of his actions.
He paused to draw breath.
I do hope, Mr. Jackson, that he's not the sort of person who, having signed an agreement, then relies on some clever lawyer to identify a loophole that will get him out of honoring it. You see, in this court I am both judge and jury, and I shall be appointing my son, Alexei, as prosecuting counsel. I have made it his personal responsibility to see that this particular contract is carried out to the letter. I have already given orders that he will accompany you both back to the United States, and he will not return until the agreement has been honored. I hope I make myself clear, Mr. Jackson.
Zarimsky's office could not have been in greater contrast to the Tsar's country palace. The communist leader occupied the third floor of a dilapidated building in a northern suburb of Moscow, although anyone who was invited to stay at his dacha on the Volga quickly became aware that Zarimsky was no stranger to luxury. The last vote had been cast at 10 o'clock the previous evening. Now all Zarimsky could do was sit and wait for the officials from the Baltic to the Pacific to count the ballot papers. He knew only too well that in some districts people would have voted several times. In others, the ballot boxes would simply never reach the town hall. But he was confident that once he had agreed terms with Borodin and the general had withdrawn from the race, he was in with a real chance of winning. But he was enough of a realist to know that with the Mafia backing Chernopov, he would need to poll well over half of the votes cast to have the slightest chance of being declared the winner. For that reason, he had decided to make an ally in the Tsar's camp. The result of the election would not be known for a couple of days, as they still tallied the votes by hand in most parts of the country. He didn't need to be reminded of Stalin's oft-quoted remark that it doesn't matter how many people vote, only who counts them. Zarimsky's inner circle were working the phones as they tried to keep track of what was happening across the vast nation, but all the state chairmen were willing to say was that it looked too close to call. The communist leader thumped the table more times that day than he had during the past week, and remained closeted in his room for long periods of time, making private calls.
"That's good news, Stefan," Zarimsky was saying, "as long as you can take care of the problem of your cousin."
He was listening to Ivanitsky's response when there was a knock on the door. He put the phone down the moment he saw his chief of staff enter the room. He had no desire for Titov to find out who he had been talking to.
The press are wondering if you'll speak to them, said Titov, hoping it might keep his master occupied for a few minutes. The last time Zarimsky had seen the vultures, as he referred to them, was the previous morning, when they had all turned out to watch him cast his vote in Kosky, the district of Moscow in which he was born. It would have been no different if he had been running for President of the United States. Zarimsky nodded reluctantly and followed Titov down the stairs and out onto the street. He had instructed his staff never to allow a member of the press to enter the building, for fear that they would discover just how inefficient and understaffed his organization was. That was something else which would change once he got his hands on the state coffers. He hadn't even told his chief of staff that if he won, this would be the last election the Russian people would vote in while he was alive. And he didn't give a damn how many protests there were in foreign newspapers and magazines. In a very short time, they would have a zero circulation east of Germany. When Zarimsky stepped out onto the pavement, he was met by the largest gathering of journalists he'd seen since the campaign had begun. "How confident are you of victory, Mr. Zarimsky?" someone shouted before he even had a chance to say good afternoon. "If the winner is the man who the most people have voted for, I will be the next president of Russia." "But the chairman of the International Panel of Observers says that this has been the most democratic election in the history of Russia. Do you not accept that judgment?" "I will, if I'm declared victor," replied Zarimsky. The journalists laughed politely at his little pun. "If elected, how long will it be before you visit President Lawrence in Washington?"
"Soon after he has visited me in Moscow," came back the immediate reply.
"If you become president, what will happen to the man who was arrested in Freedom Square and accused of plotting to assassinate you?"
"That will be a decision for the courts, but you can be sure he will receive a fair trial."
Zarimsky suddenly became bored. Without warning, he turned and disappeared back into the building, ignoring the question shouted at his retreating back.
"Have you offered Borodin a post in your cabinet? What will you do about Chechnya? Will the Mafia be your first target?"
As he wearily climbed the worn stone stairs to the third floor, he decided that win or lose, that was the last occasion he would ever speak to the press. He didn't envy Lawrence trying to run a country where journalists expected to be treated as equals. When he reached his office, he slumped into the only comfortable chair in the room and slept for the first time in days. The key turned in the lock and the cell door swung open. Bolchenkov entered carrying a large duffel bag and a battered leather briefcase. "As you see, I have returned," said St. Petersburg's chief of police, sitting down opposite Connor, "from which you can assume that I want another off-the-record chat, though I am bound to say I hope it will be a little more productive than our last encounter." The chief stared down at the man sitting on the bunk. Connor looked as if he had lost several pounds in the past 5 days. "I see that you haven't yet become accustomed to our nouvelle cuisine," said Bolchenkov, lighting a cigarette. "I must confess that it does take a few days even for the lowlife of St. Petersburg to fully appreciate the crucifix's menu. But they come round to it once they realize that they're here for the rest of their lives, and that there is no à la carte alternative." He drew deeply on his cigarette and blew the smoke out of his nose.
"In fact," he continued, "you may have read in the press quite recently that one of our inmates ate a fellow prisoner. But what with the food shortage and the problem of overcrowding, we didn't think it worth making a fuss about."
Connor smiled.
"Ah, I see you are alive, after all," said the chief. "Now, I have to tell you that there have been one or two interesting developments since our last meeting, which I have a feeling you will want to know about."
He placed the duffel bag and the briefcase on the floor.
"These two pieces of luggage were reported as unclaimed by the head porter of the National Hotel."
Connor raised an eyebrow.
"Just as I thought," said the chief. "And to be fair, when we showed him your photograph, the porter confirmed that although he remembered the man fitting your description leaving the bag, he couldn't recall the briefcase. Nevertheless, I suspect you won't need to have its contents described to you."
The chief flicked up the knobs of the case and lifted the lid to reveal a Remington 700. Connor stared straight ahead, feigning indifference. Although I am sure you have handled this type of weapon before, I am confident that you have never seen this particular rifle, despite the initials PDV being so conveniently printed on the case. Even a raw recruit could work out that you have been set up. Polchenkov drew deeply on his cigarette. The CIA must think we have the dumbest police force on Earth.
Did they imagine for a moment that we don't know what Mitchell's real job is? Cultural attaché, he snorted. He probably thinks the Hermitage is a department store.
Before you say anything, I have another piece of news that might be of interest to you.
He inhaled again, allowing the nicotine to reach down into his lungs.
Viktor Zhirinsky has won the election and will be installed as president on Monday.
Connor smiled weakly.
And as I can't imagine that he'll be offering you a front row seat for the inauguration, said the chief, perhaps the time has come for you to tell us your side of the story, Mr. Fitzgerald.
Chapter 19. President Zhirinsky swaggered into the room. His colleagues immediately rose from their places around the long oak table and applauded until he had taken his seat below a portrait of Stalin, resurrected from the basement of the Pushkin, where it had languished since 1956. Zhirinsky was dressed in a dark blue suit, white shirt, and red silk tie. He looked quite different from the other men seated round the table, who were still garbed in the ill-fitting clothes they had worn throughout the election campaign. The message was clear. They should all visit a tailor as soon as possible. Zhirinsky allowed the applause to continue for some time before waving down his colleagues as if they were just another adoring crowd.
Although I do not officially take office until next Monday, he began, there are one or two areas where I intend to make some immediate changes.
The president looked around at those supporters who had stood by him through the lean years and were about to be rewarded for their loyalty. Many of them had waited half a lifetime for this moment. He turned his attention to a short, squat man who was staring blankly in front of him. Joseph Pleskov had been promoted from Zhirinsky's bodyguard to a full member of the Politburo the day after he had shot three men who had tried to assassinate his boss while he was on a visit to Odessa. Pleskov had one great virtue, which Zhirinsky would require of any cabinet minister. As long as he understood his orders, he would carry them out.
Joseph, my old friend, Zhirinsky said, you are to be my minister of the interior.
Several faces around the table tried not to show surprise or disappointment. Most of them knew they were far better qualified to do the job than the former docker from the Ukraine, and some suspected he couldn't even spell interior. The short, thick-set man beamed at his leader like a child who had been given an unexpected toy.
Your first responsibility, Joseph, will be to deal with organized crime. I can think of no better way of setting about that task than by arresting Nikolai Romanov, the so-called Tsar. Because there will be no room for Tsars, imperial or otherwise, while I am president.
One or two of the faces that had looked sullen only a moment before suddenly cheered up. Few of them would have been willing to take on Nikolai Romanov, and none of them believed Pleskov was up to it.
What shall I charge him with? Asked Pleskov innocently. Anything you like, from fraud to murder, said Zhirinsky. Just be sure it sticks.
Pleskov was already looking a little apprehensive. It would have been easier if the boss had simply ordered him to kill the man. Zhirinsky's eyes circled the table.
Lev, he said, turning to another man who had remained blindly loyal to him, I shall give you responsibility for the other half of my law and order program.
Lev Shulov looked nervous, unsure if he should be grateful for what he was about to receive.
You are to be my new justice minister.
Shulov smiled.
Let me make it clear that there is far too much of a logjam in the courts at present. Appoint a dozen or so new judges. Be sure they are all long-standing party members. Begin by explaining to them that I have only two policies when it comes to law and order, shorter trials and longer sentences, and I am keen to make an example of someone newsworthy in the first few days of my presidency to leave no doubt about the fate of those who cross me. Did you have anyone in mind, Mr. President?
Yes, replied Zarimsky. You will remember...
There was a quiet knock on the door. Everyone turned to see who dared to interrupt the new president's first cabinet meeting. Dmitri Titov entered noiselessly, gambling that Zarimsky would have been even more annoyed not to be interrupted. The president drummed his fingers on the table as Titov walked the length of the room, then bent down and whispered in his ear. Zarimsky immediately burst out laughing. The rest of them wanted to join in, but were unwilling to until they had heard the joke. He looked up at his colleagues.
The President of the United States is on the line. It seems that he wishes to congratulate me.
Now they all felt able to join in the laughter.
My next decision as your leader is whether I should put him on hold for another 3 years.
They all laughed even louder, except for Titov.
Or whether I should take the call.
No one offered an opinion.
Shall we find out what the man wants?
Asked Zarimsky. They all nodded. Titov picked up the phone by his side and handed it to his boss.
Mr. President, said Zarimsky.
No, sir, came back the immediate reply. My name is Andy Lloyd. I am the White House Chief of Staff. May I put you through to President Lawrence?
No, you may not, said Zarimsky angrily. Tell your president next time he calls to be on the end of the line himself, because I don't deal with messenger boys.
He slammed the phone down, and they all laughed again.
Now, what was I saying?
Shulov volunteered.
You were about to tell us, Mr. President, who should be made an example of in order to demonstrate the new discipline of the Justice Department.
Ah, yes, said Zarimsky, the smile returning to his lips just as the phone rang again. Zarimsky pointed at his chief of staff, who picked up the receiver.
Would it be possible, a voice inquired, to speak to President Zarimsky?
Who's calling him? Asked Titov.
Tom Lawrence.
Titov handed the receiver to his boss.
The President of the United States, was all he said.
Zarimsky nodded and took the phone.
Is that you, Victor? This is President Zarimsky. Who am I addressing?
Tom Lawrence, said the president, raising an eyebrow to the Secretary of State and the White House Chief of Staff, who were listening in on their extensions.
Good morning. What can I do for you?
I was just calling to add my congratulations to all the others you must be receiving after your impressive...
Lawrence had wanted to say unexpected, but the State Department had counseled against it.
Victory. A very close-run thing. But everyone in politics experiences that problem from time to time.
It's not the problem I will experience again, said Zarimsky.
Lawrence laughed, assuming this was meant to be funny. He wouldn't have done so if he could have seen the stony-faced looks of those seated around the cabinet table in the Kremlin. Lloyd whispered,
Keep going.
The first thing I'd like to do is get to know you a little better, Victor. Then you will have to start by understanding that only my mother calls me by my first name.
Lawrence looked down at the notes spread across his desk. His eye settled on Zarimsky's full name, Victor Leonidovich. He underlined Leonidovich, but Larry Harrington shook his head.
I'm sorry, said Lawrence. How would you like me to address you? The same way you would expect anyone you don't know to address you.
Though they could hear only one side of it, those seated around the table in Moscow were enjoying the first encounter between the two leaders. Those in the Oval Office were not.
Try a different tack, Mr. President, suggested the Secretary of State, cupping a hand over his phone.
Tom Lawrence glanced down at Andy Lloyd's prepared questions and skipped a page.
I was hoping it wouldn't be too long before we could find an opportunity to meet.
Come to think of it, he added, it's rather surprising that we haven't bumped into each other before now.
It's not all that surprising, said Zarimsky. When you last visited Moscow in June, your embassy failed to issue me or any of my colleagues with an invitation to the dinner that was held for you.
There were murmurs of support from around the table.
Well, I'm sure you know only too well that on overseas trips one is very much in the hands of one's local officials. I shall be interested to see which of those local officials you feel need replacing after such a fundamental miscalculation.
Zaremski paused.
Starting with your ambassador, perhaps?
There followed another long silence while the three men in the Oval Office checked through the questions they had assiduously prepared. So far, they had not anticipated one of Zaremski's replies.
I can assure you, Zaremski added, that I will not be allowing any of my officials, local or otherwise, to overrule my personal wishes.
Lucky man, said Lawrence, giving up bothering with any of the prepared answers.
Luck is not a factor I ever take into consideration, said Zaremski, especially when it comes to dealing with my opponents.
Larry Harrington was beginning to look desperate, but Andy Lloyd scribbled a question on a pad and pushed it under the president's nose. Lawrence nodded.
Perhaps we should try to arrange an early meeting so that we can get to know each other a little better?
The White House trio sat waiting for the offer to be robustly rejected.
I'll give that my serious consideration, said Zaremski to everyone's surprise at both ends. Why don't you tell Mr. Lloyd to get in touch with Comrade Titov, who is responsible for organizing my meetings with foreign leaders?
I certainly will, said Lawrence, feeling relieved. I'll ask Andy Lloyd to call Mr. Titov in the next couple of days. Lloyd scribbled another note and handed it to him. It read, And of course I would be happy to visit Moscow.
Goodbye, Mr. President, said Zaremski.
Goodbye, Mr. President, Lawrence replied. As Zaremski put the phone down, he stalled the inevitable round of applause by quickly turning to his chief of staff and saying,
When Lloyd rings, he will propose that I visit Washington. Accept the offer.
His chief of staff looked surprised.
I am determined, said the president, turning back to his colleagues, that Lawrence should realize as soon as possible what sort of man he is dealing with. More importantly, I wish the American public to find out for themselves.
He placed his fingers together.
I intend to begin by making sure that Lawrence's arms reduction bill is defeated on the floor of the Senate. I can't think of a more appropriate Christmas present to give Tom.
This time he allowed them to applaud him briefly, before silencing them with another wave of his hand.
But we must return for the moment to our domestic problems, which are far more pressing. You see, I believe it is important that our own citizens are also made aware of the mettle of their new leader. I wish to provide them with an example that will leave no one in any doubt about how I intend to deal with those who consider opposing me.
They all waited to see who Zaremski had selected for this honor. He turned his gaze to the newly appointed Justice Minister.
Where is that mafia hitman who tried to assassinate me?
He's locked up in the crucifix, said Shulov, where I assume you'll want him to remain for the rest of his life.
Certainly not, said Zaremski. Life imprisonment is far too lenient a sentence for such a barbarous criminal. This is the ideal person to put on trial. We will make him our first public example.
I'm afraid the police haven't been able to come up with any proof that...
Then manufacture it, said Zaremski. His trial isn't going to be witnessed by anyone except loyal party members.
I understand, Mr. President, said the new Justice Minister.
He hesitated.
What did you have in mind?
A quick trial, with one of our new judges presiding, and the jury made up exclusively of party officials.
And the sentence, Mr. President?
The death penalty, of course. Once the sentence has been passed, you will inform the press that I shall be attending the execution.
And when will that be?
Asked the Justice Minister, writing down Zaremski's every word. The President flicked over the pages of his diary and began searching for a 15-minute gap.
8 o'clock, next Friday morning. Now, something far more important. My plans for the future of the armed forces.
He smiled at General Borodin, who was seated on his right and who hadn't yet opened his mouth.
"For you, Deputy President, the greatest prize of all."
Chapter 20. As a prisoner in the Nandin camp, Connor had developed a system for counting the days he'd been in captivity. At 5 every morning, a Viet Cong guard would appear carrying a bowl of rice swimming in water, his only meal of the day. Connor would remove a single grain and place it inside one of the 7 bamboo poles that made up his mattress. Every week, he would transfer one of the 7 grains to the beam above his bed, and then eat the other 6. Every 4 weeks, he would remove one of the grains from the beam above his bed and put it between the floorboards under his bed. The day he and Chris Jackson escaped from the camp, Connor knew he had been in captivity for 1 year, 5 months, and 2 days. But lying on a bunk in a windowless cell in the crucifix, even he couldn't come up with a system to record how long he had been there. The chief of police had now visited him twice and left with nothing. Connor began to wonder how much longer it would be before he became impatient with his simply repeating his name and nationality and demanding to see his ambassador. He didn't have to wait long to find out. Only moments after Bolchenkov had left the room the second time, the 3 men who had greeted him on the afternoon of his arrival came charging into his cell. 2 of them dragged him off the bunk and threw him into the chair recently occupied by the chief. They wrenched his arms behind his back and handcuffed him. That was when Connor first saw the cutthroat razor. While 2 of them held him down, the 3rd took just 14 strokes of the rusty blade to shave every hair off his head, along with a considerable amount of skin. He hadn't wasted any time applying soap and water. The blood continued to run down Connor's face and soak his shirt, long after they had left him slumped in the chair. He recalled the words of the chief when they had first met. "I don't believe in torture. It's not my style." But that was before Zarimsky had become president. He eventually slept, but for how long he couldn't tell. The next thing he remembered was being pulled up off the floor, hurled back into the chair, and held down for a second time. The 3rd man had replaced his razor with a long, thick needle and used the same degree of delicacy he had shown as a barber to tattoo the number 12995 on the prisoner's left wrist. They obviously didn't believe in names when you booked in for room and board at the crucifix. When they returned a 3rd time, they yanked him up off the floor and pushed him out of the cell into a long, dark corridor. It was at times like this that he wished he lacked any imagination. He tried not to think about what they might have in mind for him. The citation for his Medal of Honor had described how Lieutenant Fitzgerald had been fearless in leading his men, had rescued a brother officer, and had made a remarkable escape from a North Vietnamese prisoner of war camp. But Connor knew he had never come across a man who was fearless. In Nandin, he had held out for 1 year, 5 months, and 2 days. But then he was only 22. And at 22, you believe you're immortal. When they hurled him out of the corridor and into the morning sun, the first thing Connor saw was a group of prisoners erecting a scaffold. He was 51 now. No one needed to tell him he wasn't immortal. When Joan Bennett checked in for work at Langley that Monday, she knew exactly how many days she had served of her 8-month sentence, because every evening, just before she left home, she would feed the cat and cross off one more date on the calendar hanging on the kitchen wall. She left her car in the west parking lot and headed straight for the library. Once she had signed in, she took the metal staircase down to the reference section. For the next 9 hours, with only a break for a meal at midnight, she would read through the latest batch of emailed newspaper extracts from the Middle East. Her main task was to search for any mention of the United States, and, if it was critical, electronically copy it, collate it, and email it to her boss on the 3rd floor, who would consider its consequences at a more civilized hour later that morning. It was tedious, mind-deadening work. She had considered resigning on several occasions, but was determined not to give Guttenberg that satisfaction.
It was just before her midnight meal break that Jones spotted a headline in the Istanbul News, "Mafia Killer to Go on Trial." She could still only think of the mafia as being Italian and was surprised to discover that the article concerned a South African terrorist on trial for the attempted murder of the new president of Russia. She would have taken no further interest if she hadn't seen the line drawing of the accused man. Joan's heart began to thump as she carefully read through the lengthy article by Fatima Kuzman, the Istanbul News' Eastern European correspondent, in which she claimed to have sat next to the professional killer during a rally in Moscow which Zarimsky had addressed. Midnight passed, but Joan remained at her desk. As Connor stood in the prison courtyard and stared up at the half-constructed scaffold, a police car drew up, and one of the thugs shoved him into the back seat. He was surprised to find the chief of police waiting for him. Volchenkov hardly recognized the gaunt, crop-headed man. Neither of them spoke as the car made its way through the gates and out of the prison. The driver turned right and drove along the banks of the Neva at exactly 50 kilometers an hour. They passed three bridges before swinging left and crossing a fourth that would take them into the center of the city. As they crossed the river,